From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Eunjung Cho, broadcaster in VOA's Korean service. Our guest on this edition of the program is Frank Ahrens, former journalist with The Washington Post and author of the recently published book, Soul Man, a memoir of cars, culture, crisis, and unexpected hilarity inside a Korean corporate titan. The Seoul in Soul Man, of course, refers to the capital of South Korea, where Ahrens and his wife were stationed for 3 years. A Foreign Service officer, Rebecca, his wife, was about to begin her first overseas posting at the American Embassy in Seoul. Frank left a 21-year career as a journalist to embark on a career in public relations. In Seoul, he became the director of global communications for Hyundai Motor, Korea's second-largest company behind Samsung and the fifth-largest car manufacturer in the world. In his book, Soul Man, Frank Ahrens chronicles the challenges of navigating the various cultural, social, and political minefields at home and work. We learn about J-ball, kimchi, and soju. Don't worry, we'll define those terms during our show, and how these concepts become lenses through which to better understand what makes South Korea tick. Currently, Frank is a vice president at BGR Public Relations. That's a lobbying firm based here in Washington. And he joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington to discuss his new book, Soul Man. Frank, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Carol.
Absolutely. I'm also delighted to welcome my colleague, Eunjung Cho, our Korean service. Well, Frank, so you gave up a career in journalism to join your wife in Seoul. Talk about how your experience in South Korea and at Hyundai Motor in particular changed the trajectory of your life and even your worldview.
No, absolutely. Well, sort of the elevator pitch I have for the book is me, Hyundai, and Korea all hit our midlife crises at the same moment. And it's not the sort of get a Corvette midlife crisis, but the one where you sort of spend your first 20 or so years in the workforce working and striving, and then you sort of pull up and look around and you think, am I where I thought I would be or who I thought I would be? And you take stock and you figure out, do I have a second act? And while I was trying to figure out if I had a second act after journalism, and in fact, a second act after a lifetime bachelorhood and becoming married at age 44, whatever I was, Hyundai was also looking to transition from being a well-thought-of volume car maker, meaning equivalent to, say, Honda or Toyota, and wanted to move up to become a premium automaker, wanted to set its sights on BMW and Audi and Mercedes. And at the same time, Korea realized it was at this pivot point, too. It had this amazing growth story, built largely on the back of the great Chaebol, which you had mentioned. A Chaebol is a family-owned conglomerate. We know them as Samsung, LG, Hyundai. But Korea realized it had to diversify as an economy. It had to create a more service-based economy and a startup economy. So all three of us sort of found ourselves at the same sort of precipice of the second act to figure out what would it be. And the jury is out, I think, on all of us. I mean, I'm still successfully married, thank goodness, and we have two lovely children. And Hyundai is working to pull its brand up market, and Korea is working to try to diversify, but these are long-term projects.
Indeed. Well, it's working to try to diversify, Frank Ahrens. But nonetheless, it seems that this concept of Chaebol, this family-owned conglomerate that has apparently no equal here in the United States, is still going strong. Please talk about how and why Hyundai Motor and this Chaebol provides a window into the corporate culture of
Sure.
South Korea.
So a way to think about it is that Korea compressed about 150 years of industrialization into about 50. No other economy has done that in the modern world. Modern Korea, as we think of it now, started in 1961 when military officer Park Chung-hee took over the country in a military coup. And he said, we are going to have a manufacture and export philosophy. That is going to be our economy. And with low interest loans and very tight cooperation between the government and that time young startup entrepreneurs who went on to found Samsung and Hyundai, they built national champions. And these companies, Hyundai, Samsung, LG, we haven't seen the equal of them in the U.S. since the late 19th century, since Getty and Vanderbilt controlled huge swaths of the American economy. And so you don't walk away from that in just a minute. And so they took Korea to where it is now. But Korea looks at Japan and they see examples of 2 decades of stagnation, and you see the limits of that kind of growth.
Now I'd like to turn to my colleague, Eun-jung, for a question.
Frank, it seems you're very successful in your second egg. Congratulations.
Well, so far the returns are positive. Thank you.
Frank, I came to the States 10 years ago, straight from Seoul, and I could relate to your experience as someone who was trying to fit into another culture. What really struck me the most when I first came to the States was, and this is directly related to your experience in Seoul as well, which is that how people here smile at each other and they make small talks at the elevators, and they don't do this in Seoul.
Right.
And I just thought that Americans are more friendly or Americans are more polite, but you analyzed a deeper cultural reason why Koreans don't do that. Tell us why.
Well, it's funny because when I got to Korea, I would make small talk with people in the elevators and nobody would answer me. And I would hold the door open for people and no one would hold it open for me. And right. I thought, I'm in the rudest country in the world. But then the longer I was there and the more I learned, I came to understand that by trying to talk to this stranger in the elevator, I was violating some pretty deep-held cultural beliefs. He didn't know me and I didn't know him. We would only be known if we had been formally introduced through a business or a personal relationship, in which case, then we might be like brothers. We would go out, we would go drinking, we would do business deals together, but I hadn't crossed that threshold, right? And so what I was doing, he was not being rude by not answering me, I was being rude by trying to talk to him. And I came to understand that my perceptions of rudeness or a personal space, all these things were like 180 degrees different. And I had to realign myself to understand what it's like to live in a Confucian culture, which is hierarchical, which is formal, where you refer your boss by his last name and title even outside of work. And if you see him on the street, you may not say hi to him because you don't have an appointment to see him, right? And it would be interrupting him. And so I had to shift my reality 180 degrees. And then finally, after half a year or so, I started to behave a little more politely in Korea.
Right. So how do Koreans bond and make deeper relationships in your observations? How would you describe it?
Well, I came to sort of think of the Korean relationship as kind of binary. You are either a stranger or family. And the way it happened, at least in the Korean workplace culture, is the hweshik, or drinking dinner, right. Essentially mandated drinking dinner. And it could happen 4:30 in the afternoon. Your team leader could come over and say, hweshik tonight. And you and your six or seven or eight teammates should probably break the plans you had for that evening and go to the drinking dinner with your boss. And so you go out and you go to maybe a Korean barbecue restaurant and you've got sizzling beef in the middle of the table and you start drinking soju, the national drink, which is about a clear alcohol, about 20% alcohol, in shots. And you do shots and you toast each other. And after a while, everyone, as a Korean friend of mine said, same level of drunk and the same. It's a leveling effect and then it's a really a bonding effect. And there was this sort of tight bonding and maybe even instantaneous tight bonding that as an American, I didn't understand. We take time. I take time to build up friendships in the U.S., right? But man, it can happen right away over a drinking dinner or two. And then of course, after the drinking dinner, there's karaoke or norebang, music room. And unlike in the U.S., in Asia, norebang karaoke is no joke. I mean, it's serious. And everyone's got to have their go-to norebang song. And so that was what I at least learned in the workplace. And the bonding is important because the next day you come in, and even if you're all hungover, you're a hungover team. And that is meant to build a team tightness to achieve the targets and achieve the goals in a way that I wasn't familiar with in the U.S.
I wanted to follow up on that because I remember going to those hweshiks and I remember those hangovers. But how does that translate into productivity? How does that translate into South Korea's economic growth?
Well, it's a really good question. And, you know, if you look at statistics, you will often find that South Korea will lead its neighbors in hours worked, but be maybe middle of the pack in productivity, however you measure that. And, you know, you come into work at 7:30 or 7:15 the next morning, and the guy next to you may have his head down on his desk for an hour or so, and your team leader will cut him some slack because he's been out doing the corporate-required bonding the previous night. And the South Korean government is now finally understanding over the recent years not just obviously the poor effects, health effects of excessive drinking, but the loss in productivity. And so they've been running public service ads saying, hey, let's back off on the Wayshake a bit. We're hurting ourselves with productivity. And this is especially important as the South Korean economy has flattened off a bit in recent years. I mean, in the period of the past four decades, they've been used to 10% double-digit annual growth, much like China was a decade ago. Mm-hmm. But as you develop, your economic growth, you know, flattens out. And they know they have to become more efficient. And part of that is becoming more productive. And part of that is backing off the Huayshik a little.
That sounds good.
But on a frank, these Huayshik dinners where you're expected to drink soju, I can't imagine that everybody appreciates that or is willing to do that. Even though the workplace is relatively homogeneous and you were probably one of the few Americans, but what about...
Only American.
The only American. Okay, but what if somebody doesn't like to drink or can't for health reasons, mm-hmm. religious or others? How do they navigate this?
So that's a really good question. And so that is another sign of how Korea is beginning to evolve. So if you have a medical condition, you're excused essentially from Wayshik. You can go out. If you don't drink alcohol at all or can't drink alcohol, that's understood. But if you just don't want to get drunk all the time, that has been held against you. You are seen sometimes as being self-righteous, right? And you know, who are you to not get drunk with us? And in fact, I had some of my coworkers who would slide in next to me at dinner and sort of confide, you know, I do not like to drink that much either, but if I don't, it will hurt my career. And for me, it was a real hurdle going to Korea because I enjoy a good beer. But my wife and I are both Christian, and we are instructed not to not drink. Jesus had wine at Passover, but not to get drunk. And so how would I rectify this without offending my new coworkers and hosts? And I consulted people, and I asked for advice, and what I eventually ended up doing was I would participate in the drinking dinner and get my shot glass filled with soju, and for every shot everyone took, which was bottoms up, I would take a sip. And so by the end of the night, I'd had maybe one or two shots of soju instead of 10 or 12, but I was participating and I was in the ritual and trying to show that I respected it. But it was a real obstacle at first. I had something I had to confront and to deal with. But now part of this public service campaign the Korean government's putting on is, hey, you know, maybe you're pressuring people who don't want to drink as much. And this is sort of the beginning of what you're starting to see is the rise of sort of incipient individualism mm-hmm. within what has been a largely communal culture for a long time.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Frank Ahrens. He's vice president at BGR Public Relations in Washington and the author of Soul Man, a memoir of cars, culture, crisis, and unexpected hilarity inside a Korean corporate titan. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Eunjung Cho. She's a broadcaster in VOA's Korean service. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Mahmoud Jimeta, a loyal listener from Kaduna State, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, Frank, before I turn back to my colleague, let me ask you a quick follow-up with regard to these cross-cultural challenges. You also say in the book that not only do Koreans and Americans, for example, speak different languages, but we interpret social etiquette and behaviors very differently. You know, one behavior in one culture is seen as polite, and in the other, it's seen as rude. And you talk about a so-called napkin episode.
Right. If the napkin episode had happened a week after I had arrived in Korea, rather than a month or two before I left, things would have gone smoother for everyone. I was out at Wayshik with my all-Korean team members, and we were eating. And I wanted a napkin, and there was one in front of the young woman team member next to me. And I asked her to pass it to me, and she did. And this was a young woman who'd spent a year in the U.S. as an exchange student. And she said, did you ask me to pass you the napkin? Because in your culture, it's considered rude to stick your hand in front of somebody while they're eating. And I said, yes, yes, that's right. And she said, well, in our culture, it can be considered rude to interrupt somebody while they're eating to ask for something. And so maybe that was the moment that crystallized it in my mind that each culture was trying to do what it believed to be the most polite thing in regard to the other culture, but was in fact doing the rudest thing possible. And that's part of this whole 180-degree reorientation that anyone who's going to go to East Asia and interface with Confucian culture needs to understand.
Indeed. A question from Eunjung.
Lucky for you, Frank, that you have a very long arms. Well, I want to discuss jeong with you and, you know, follow up on those questions. Help our audience understand, what is jeong?
Okay, so I'm going to tell you what I know, but I want you to chime in too to make sure I'm not getting this crucial cultural concept wrong. Mm-hmm. So jeong, it's too gross of a word to say it's love or affection for your brotherhood. Researchers will say jeong is a feeling that not just goes from person to person, but can permeate among people. And a Korean coworker of mine once said it to me in very succinct terms is, jeong is the feeling that even if you hate somebody's guts, you understand their situation. And that helped me a little bit, but I think there's something even deeper to it as well. I don't know if it's a function of homogeneity of culture or if it's a function of sort of us against the world in the way that Koreans have felt for hundreds of years, right? I think it is certainly related with the concept of Han, which is the sort of collective emotional melancholy, which is, oh, we've been invaded a million times over 1,000 years, the thing's gonna go bad, but yet we will persevere. One day we will get our justice. So these were two really important concepts that I tried to understand and to get at. Am I close on these?
Yeah, you're very correct. And I would also add to that, I would put it as somebody grows on you. Somebody grows on you.
Oh, that's good.
You may not like that person, but somebody grows on you. Uh-huh. And that would be jeong. I would put it that way.
Oh, that's good. I will add that to my working definition.
Right,
excellent. Yeah.
Right. And you also describe how South Koreans grow jeong on North Koreans.
Yeah, you know, as an outsider going to South Korea, I could never figure out why anybody in South Korea, or Korea, as South Koreans would say, has the least bit of sympathy toward North Korea or idea for appeasement with North Korea. How can you consider talking to this thuggish dictatorship that has only tricked you many times over the years? And on a government-to-government relationship, I still see that, but on a person-to-person relationship, my view has changed. Not only the fact that there are still very old, but still separated families on both sides of the border, but again, it's that idea that even if these Koreans in the North are underneath the rule of a neo-Stalinist criminal state, they're still Koreans, and we still have the same DNA, and we still have more or less the same language, and the same heritage and history. And so, yeah, it's a complicated relationship, right?
So is it because of this jeong that South Koreans don't go nervous when North Korea provokes with missiles and nuclear tests?
Maybe it's that, but I also think you sort of get used to living next to the bully next door in some ways. I mean, I wrote a piece on this recently because every time I was in South Korea and I'd like get a nervous Facebook message from somebody back here in the States, like, are you okay? I'm like, why? What happened? And it turned out Kim Jong-il or Un had said something really provocative, but you sort of get used to it and you miss it after a while. Yeah, I didn't see it. But I think there's a feeling among South Koreans that the North will never launch a full-out attack because they know of the U.S. and South Korea ROK retaliation would be obliterative, but also the feeling that Beijing holds some kind of leash on Pyongyang. I'm not sure that leash is as tight as it used to be, especially with Kim Jong-un in control. But there is a semi-sense of security that, if, for instance, back in the 90s, there were times, you remember maybe, when shelves were empty in South Korean stores when it looked like attack was imminent. That doesn't happen anymore, right? Even when they're setting off nuclear devices. I mean, I came there in 2010, right after the North shelled Yongpyeong Island. And I thought, okay, great, this is my life. I'm in a war zone. And then after 6 months, I kind of forgot about it.
So one more follow-up. If you could just give us an example or an episode how you observed your South Koreans around you in your company that they were so calm in one of those provocations.
Well, I will tell you, the day of the Yongpyeong shelling was in November 2010. Yongpyeong Island's about 70 miles northwest of downtown Seoul, where we were, and I was in a high rise, and we didn't learn about the shelling until about 4 hours after it happened. But right when it was happened, fighter jets screamed low over our 21-story Hyundai Tower. When you hear a fighter jet come by, it's terrifying, at least for me. So I stood up and looked out at the window, and I went out to my team. I said, did you see that? And they're like, what? What? I said, I think fighter jets went over. And they're like, okay. And I was, what do you think happened? Well, we don't know. And then it turned out the news came out, oh, it was that far. Yeah, okay, we're fine. And so the other thing that shocked me was when Kim Jong-il died in December 2011, I think it was, the news came out around noon, Seoul time. And about 7 hours, 8 hours later, I drive home to where I was living, and we had a security guard out front, a guy named Henry, lovely old Korean guy, loved to practice his English, delightful guy. And I said, hey, Henry, big news today. And he said, why? What happened? I said, Kim Jong-il died, the mortal enemy of your country. And he's like, I hadn't heard. And I'm like, how is that possible, right? Henry works with Koreans. You would think the news would get around, but he hadn't heard. And who knows exactly why he hadn't heard, but I was immediately struck with this idea that I could live here 40 years and still not figure it out entirely. And that story just sticks with me.
Well, in addition to living, 30 miles from the border with North Korea and a neo-Stalinist police state, as you said, Korea, you say in the book, is like the shrimp between two whales, Japan and China,
right,
with the, you say, madman next door, right?
Right.
But let's talk about the relationship between South Korea and Japan and China. How did you experience that?
So geographically, Korea is stuck to China. It's on the shares a border with, and then it's across the East Sea of Korea from Japan. And throughout the past 1,000 or 1,500 years or so, both China and Japan have set their sights on Korea. Japan mostly, seeing Korea as a gateway to invade and conquer China. And the Japanese launched numerous attacks on Korea and nearly took it several times. And so there's been a long adversarial relationship between Japan and Korea. With China, it's a bit more complicated because Confucianism came from China to Korea, to the Korean Peninsula. Trade happened. I mean, for a long, long time, Korea was a vassal state of the Chinese emperor and paid a yearly tribute to it. So there was a relationship, even though it was senior to junior, higher to lower, there was a relationship that wasn't necessarily combative as it was with Japan. And that has gone on, you know, really in many ways to this day. Last year, Japan and Korea, government to government and on paper, finally settled the comfort woman issue, which is the sex slaves that the Japanese Imperial Army took from the countries it invaded in prior to and during World War II in China, Korea, and elsewhere, the colonies, and finally made an official formal apology from the government, agreed to pay funds to the remaining 40-some or so comfort women in Korea, and acknowledged for the first time that the Japanese government military had a role in creating this system. That was a huge diplomatic win for South Korea. More to the point, it really removed the major obstacle left to having these two, what should be natural allies that share so much in culture, get a closer relationship, especially now in terms of intelligence sharing when it comes to North Korea and both great allies of the U.S. And then how do we deal with China and the rise of China? South Korea has been trying to play sort of a three-dimensional chess game under the current president, Park Geun-hye, between Washington and Beijing, which is to say, wanting to quite naturally improve relationships with Beijing while not making Washington feel like we're losing Korea to Beijing, right? And so this has been a very delicate balance, and it was succeeding fairly well right up until North Korea started testing nuclear bombs again, and China didn't really do enough in terms of trying to help. They agreed with the Security Council resolution, that's great, but didn't do quite enough. And so the US and South Korea decided to bring in the missile defense system, and that really makes China upset. And so it's a very complicated situation. But the point is, if you're Korea, you have to always deal with Japan and China. They're always there,
right?
And I think the improving relations between Korea and Japan, specifically from Park Geun-hye and Shinzo Abe, is encouraging. And it's not something I would have seen when Abe was reelected a few years ago, because Abe is a very nationalist background, and there was a lot of suspicion in Korea. So that part is certainly encouraging.
Well, I'd like to talk about Korean codes that you referred to in the book. And you already referred to Confucianism, which is considered a way to order society based on hierarchy, wealth, social status, birth, gender, as you said, coming from China, respect for the elder suffuses society, and of course, Koreanness. Talk about how these concepts are still important today, or do you see other influences?
I think the answer is yes to both. Korea never will and should never stop being Korea, right? One of the things that's great about Korea is that so much of the world, at least the major cities, have become kind of, if not homogenous, familiar to us when you go around the world. When you go to Korea, you are in a foreign country and you get it right away. Most of the signs are in Korean, some are in English, but in Korea, it's homogenous. You feel like you're in a different place. Now, that's really fun for a couple weeks if you're going to visit a place. Mm-hmm. Living there for 3 years can make it difficult if you're a foreigner, right? But you come to appreciate it has an identity.
But there's a pressure to conform. That's perhaps the darker
side. Yeah, I think,
side.
You know, every culture has its pressures to achieve and to hit certain cultural signifiers, right? And one thing I didn't understand about Korea until it was explained to me was, I said to a friend of mine, I said, how is it that you guys are like the most competitive in the world in terms of education? And like everything in Korea is a competition, right? Mm-hmm. Drinking to right. school, to work, to all that. So you're competing. But at the same time, there's this pressure not to stand out from the crowd. And
I found that is rather right? contradictory myself.
He told me, he said, sir, we compete so hard so we won't stand out from the crowd. In right. other words, we won't be left behind.
Right.
And that has been the way that Korea got to where it is now in terms of the 10th or 12th largest economy, whatever it is. But I will tell you, there are signs of change as the country becomes more global and more Koreans go out and live and come back and mm-hmm. bring back, just like any other place, right? Mm-hmm. And there was a young man on my team, Eduardo, in the book. He's about 25. He did the right thing, got great grades, went to a great university and got his job at Hyundai. Could have been there for life. And he just said, you know what, sir? Chaebol life is not for me. He said, I know what my salary is going to be 20 years from now. And for him, that was a prison sentence. For a previous generation, that was a godsend. And he left, got a little startup money, built a hotel, and now he's an entrepreneur in the service sector, which is exactly what Korea needs.
Yeah, I mean, like me and my friends and my husband, we say like the young generation, they're so different from us in thinking. Like
you say the young generation?
Yeah, we really say that those people who are born after 1990, they think totally different from us. That's what we realize as well.
I saw a survey recently. The question was asked of Koreans, is it a good thing or a bad thing that we are a homogenous culture? And the overall number was down about 10% from a survey taken 10 years ago. And it was down most especially among people under 25 or 30 who think the culture should be more diverse. And in fact, is becoming more diverse through international marriages. Korean women are incredibly well-educated, like even more so than the men on average. And so they go to Seoul, they go to the university, they get their degrees, and they leave behind these poor farm boys, right? And none of these educated women want to marry them. And so brides are coming in from Indonesia and from the Philippines mm-hmm. and from Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine told me a few weeks ago that 10% of all new marriages in Korea are multi-ethnic. And that's an amazingly huge stat. And that will begin to change the country.
I'd like to close the interview, Frank, on a lighter note. So now that you're back here in the United States, do you miss the ubiquitous smell of kimchi?
Well,
talk about that.
Okay, well, here's what's funny is you can get nostalgic for the funniest things and sometimes even for things you maybe didn't initially like. Kimchi is a very strong smell for those of you who don't know it. It's fermented garlic. You bury it in the ground. It builds up its power and it is served with every Korean meal. It's a national dish. And I got to tell you, it was a bit strong for me and I never really warmed up to it. But I have to tell you, we were in an Asian market recently, my wife and I, and I got a whiff of it. And man, like smell is a memory key, right? And it took me right back to Seoul. And it took me back to a lot of good things. Now, I didn't buy it. I didn't take it home to eat it. But that smell took me back and it was pleasurable, I have to say.
Let's go back to the book's title, Seoul Man, a memoir of cars, culture, crisis, and unexpected hilarity inside a Korean corporate titan. What about that unexpected hilarity?
Oh, man. Well, part of it was me being, you know, completely unprepared to enter this different culture and me goofing up a lot. But others was just like on a daily basis. One time Eduardo came into my office and he was acting a little sheepish. And I'm like, Eduardo, what is it? He said, sir, I got a hair transplant. I'm like, what are you talking about? It's like he had a mop of hair, you know, the great Korean young male haircut, thick bangs all the way down. I'm like, where did you possibly get more hair? And he was worried that he started to have the beginning of a receding hairline. So he went to a doctor where they took a chunk of hair out of his back of his head like a divot and planted it up front. And I was like, are you crazy? He said, so I'm not going bald now, but I may someday. And it was funny because he had solicited the opinions of all the other members of his team. They all thought it was foresight and smart. And I'm like, this is ridiculous. But it wasn't in that culture because where everything is a competition, that made sense. And if you don't get plastic surgery, if you don't do these things, you're viewed as, you know, not taking advantage of everything you should to keep up. And it was moments like that that just made me laugh out loud, but they always taught me a lesson. And it was always something I could take away to help me understand a little better.
Yeah, I want to add to that because Koreans are very conscious of what other people think of you, men and women alike. I think that's why Eduardo got the hair transplant.
When it was sunny, I'd put my sunglasses on and I'd look around. And I was like, how come not everyone is wearing sunglasses or holding papers over their eyes or had the Ajumma visors? And I would say, why aren't you wearing sunglasses? He says, well, like, sir, you know, maybe if you put on sunglasses, other people might think, oh, that guy's trying to be too cool. So, okay, you squint into the sun instead.
The book is Seoul Man, a memoir of cars, culture, crisis, and
Unexpected Hilarity, Inside a Korean Corporate Titan. The author, Frank Ahrens, we greatly enjoyed having you, talking about your new book. Thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, 감사합니다. Thank you both very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. 감사합니다.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Joe Gill, and joining me on the program was Njung Cho, broadcaster in VOA's Korean service. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.